Sweet. All right, we are live. So, got the wonderful Mac Lackey here again. This is sort of by request from the group. I met Mac a while back, and he's become an amazing part of Baby Bathwater. Attended a few events, got pretty engaged in the group. Then we found out more about his genius and what he's done, flipping a few businesses and how he operated it. Asked him to speak. Spoke in Croatia, was a big hit there. COVID has hit. We've been doing more of these virtual things, and we did a pretty light sort of podcast interview style one, and many people wanted to hear more. So Max, it'd be nice enough to come put a presentation together for us here. So thank
Great.
You.
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me. I will share my screen and we will we'll do a couple of quick slides, and then happy to take any questions or anything. But let me put this in present mode. So I'm going to talk about creating exit opportunities. And one of the big ideas that has kind of developed over the years for me is that being ready and able to sell at maximum value just means you have options. And the reason that's so important is some people don't know if they want to sell their company. They don't know what the time frame looks like. They don't know the criteria. But I have, you know, found over the years that really optimizing so that you have the option is what's so powerful. So that's kind of the frame that I use when I sort of think about exits. By background, I will not belabor this at all, but the key point is, you know, over the last 25 years, you know, I started my first sort of web 1.0 company early 95, just after Netscape launched the commercial browser. And so over the 25 years, I started, scaled up, and exited 6 companies. And probably most interestingly, you know, I sold to public companies, I sold to private companies, I sold domestically, I sold internationally. So I got a lot of different perspective on what works and what doesn't work. And the other thing is, in addition to kind of my personal exits, which again, were just really inside views of how this process worked, I've also been a pretty prolific angel investor and mentor to, you know, over 50 companies at this point now. And then I spent about 6 years on the board of a public company called LendingTree, which was doing a lot of acquisitions on the buy side. So seeing it from the completely opposite point of view of the seller, I got to see it as a buyer. So that's, you know, real quick, my background. But one of the things that I think for a founder and entrepreneur is, it's really common to see the headlines, right? You hear about a huge exit, you hear about these life-changing exits or even IPOs, and so they feel like they're kind of everywhere. You're always hearing about them. But the reality, which is kind of the cold water, is that only about 1 out of every 5 companies that are trying to exit ever close a transaction. So the odds are kind of low, and it's a little bit surprising. And in particular, over the next decade or so, there are going to be just an absolute mad dash for the exit door. Some of that's based on the baby boom generation, you know, kind of retiring out of their businesses, but about $10 trillion worth of companies. But tragically, there's only going to be about 20 or 30% of those that want to sell that ever find a buyer. And maybe not surprisingly, there's really even a smaller percentage that I imagine is probably low single digits that will know when they exit that they've truly maximized value. And that's sort of a tragedy to me. And then some of the other statistics that I think are really troubling, you know, 80% of founders haven't sought any advice on how or when or if they will sell. They don't really know how to do that. And most have no exit plan to at all. They hope to create one, but they don't have one. So I would say, you know, probably the biggest message of all, and I try to say this to almost every founder or entrepreneur, is that if you wait for buyers to show up, not only are the odds so stacked against you that your odds of exiting are really low, but the chances are really high you're going to leave, and I quote unquote, millions on the table. So it's relative, right? If you're running a 7 or 8 figure business, it's millions. If you're running a 8, 9 figure business, it could be tens of millions. And, you know, it's sort of a relative term, but you just don't want to leave all that money on the table. So I have this long exercise that I normally would do, but to be efficient, I have this program that I sort of call the football field valuation. And all it does is it takes your historical last 12 months revenue and EBITDA and sort of maps it out on the soccer field. And the gist of it is to say, this is how the market currently views your company. And to cut to the chase, the most common multiples for businesses that are sold are based on EBITDA. And in 2018, the average exit was 4.7 times EBITDA. So that is generally how the market views a company. It doesn't matter if it's health tech, biotech, supplements, financial services. There is just kind of this broad average of a low, in my opinion, low EBITDA multiple. So the question for a founder becomes, you know, would you sell your company for 4.7 times EBITDA or even 7 times EBITDA? Because that a lot of people would say that's the high end of the range for the averages, right? So if the answer to that is no, you're in good company. But the problem is you have to shift your thinking, because that is, if you were just to sort of go to the market and just go through the motions, one, chances of exiting are low. Two, you're likely to get an offer like 4.7 times EBITDA. So you have to shift your thinking about how you're going to exit. So I like to give you some examples that really are known giant companies because they have defied the odds, right? So if you look back over the last couple of years, some of the big headlines with companies that we know, you can see that Microsoft paid over $1 billion for Yammer. That was at 40 times revenue, not EBITDA, but revenue. Yahoo purchases Tumblr for over $1 billion at 85 times. There's all these examples, and probably the most extreme, where Facebook buys WhatsApp for $19 billion with almost no revenue, right? So these are not 4.7 times EBITDA. These are extremely outlier, defying the odds kind of companies. So for me, it's like, okay, what is it that these people, these companies are doing? What's so different about the ones that defy the odds in that way? So I really want to touch on four things that most companies, most founders, most entrepreneurs don't do that are some of the reasons that these companies defy the odds, and the reason that of my 6 exits, I never sold on a financial multiple. So let's touch on these quickly, and I'm going to go through them fast so I can save time for questions. The first and most important, these companies were sold based on their strategic value to the buyer. They were not financial deals. There's not one company that was listed there that was, despite the fact that they were tied to metrics, meaning 85 times revenue, that is not why the deal closed. They were closed based on strategic value. So critical shift number one of the four is you have to focus on building and articulating strategic value. So what does that mean? That basically means in our process, we go through and help companies identify all these various things. It's basically a long brainstorm of a list that I'll sort of share with you here. It's like, what do buyers want and need? Because the reality is, it is so rare for a buyer to buy a company because they actually care about the EBITDA. Not that they don't want the EBITDA to underpin the fact that the business is doing well, if it's profitable and it operates at a good margin and it's growing quickly. Those are all check marks. Those all matter, but that's not the real driver of the best deals. The driver tends to be some of the things like this, right? It's that you have customers that they want or need that they can't reach without someone like you. They're trying to expand geographically. Maybe it's an international company trying to expand into the US. Maybe it's an East Coast firm trying to go West. You know, all these different reasons to sort of expand. Many companies are looking for new or better products to add to their suite of products. A lot of times, your brand is more powerful than your acquirers. I mean, I'm living in a town where one of the largest banks in the world started as North Carolina National Bank. And every time it would do an acquisition, it would take on the name of the company it acquired, which is now Bank of America. That started as a very small community bank called North Carolina National Bank. They were buying brands. They were buying customers. And that's the way they built one of the top 10 banks in the world. In a lot of cases, people are looking for intellectual capital or intellectual property. Maybe you have a proprietary process or a trademark that they want. So all of these things are what drive acquisitions that defy the odds. And my view is that not only do you want to have these things, you want to stack as many as possible in your favor so that when people are looking at your organization, yeah, they may look at EBITDA, they may look at your revenue, they may talk about gross margin, but what they're really doing is looking at this stack of value that you have created that is worth so much more. So that's really what drives it. So critical shift number two, when you think about, you know, what you need to do is you have to develop what I call an irresistible exit story. And this comes from one of my mentors early in my career. He used to always say, Mac, every business has an arc. It's kind of the natural progression of a way a business is growing. Year over year, you've got some curve that you're on. Hopefully it's up and to the right, but sometimes it isn't. But that's kind of the arc of the business. And so when you're out talking about your company, that's where people tend to go. They start talking about year one, year two, last 12 months revenue, our growth, our margin improvement, our number of customers. And that's all basically backward looking or current state. And so that's kind of the arc of a business. But the powerful thing to talk about is selling potential. It's not talking about where you've been, but it's talking about where you're going and how you're likely to get there. So when you start thinking about, you know, why someone would buy your business and why someone would pay you a off-market premium for it, it's never going to be because of those historical performances. It's going to be because they believe you're going somewhere powerful and important, or you have something that will help them get there. So that is a really, really different view than most people have. Most bankers, most M&A advisors, most attorneys will talk about those historical things. So I really recommend that you think about your future prospects. So people want to buy a business that's doing well, but what they really want is they want to imagine, and you need to help them imagine, what's possible if they owned your products. What could they do with your brand? What could they do if they had your customer list to sell their products into? When they think that your intellectual property is their market differentiator, the more they start thinking about that future and they start seeing that future, that's when the numbers kind of jump off the spreadsheet. One of my business partners used to call it my X factor, because I would get people to sort of move off the spreadsheet and look out into the future. And so as a founder, as an entrepreneur, you can help them visualize this. You can help them kind of get out of the spreadsheets and start looking at what does a combined company look like. You can do this with each prospective buyer that you're talking to, or even if you're talking to investors, even if you're talking about strategic, you know, partners to recap your business, you can use your strengths and talk about how they're going to be even better when they buy you. If they have 10 developers and you have one, imagine what's possible with your engineering staff now. If you have a weakness, then all of a sudden you can mitigate the risk of that weakness and you can paint a picture where that's going to go away when you sell the company. So you're painting the picture of what's possible in the future, and you do it with storytelling and telling this irresistible exit story. I've got a little process and I'm happy to send this to anybody that wants it, but it's basically taking, you know, what I call my 10 big points and trying to find these things that are your strengths so that when you're in the storytelling mode, they're top of mind and you can really pull them out and give people this powerful vision. But ultimately, this is a great quote. I think I put my name on it, even though there's no way I said this originally, but the easiest exit is to sell what the market wants to buy. And that is the whole idea behind the irresistible exit story. And I'm going to give you a really, really fast example, pardon the brevity, but I had a company many years ago called Kick. It was a technology company focused on youth soccer. And as we got to this inflection point, we had raised, you know, $4 or $5 million. We were starting to compete with some really, really big companies, and we had to either raise capital or sell the company. We decided to go out into the market and create a little bit of demand. And I ended up having two buyers that made it pretty far into the process. So I want to give you a quick example here. Buyer number one was a large mobile application development company based in Colorado. They dominated what I call the team messaging. So if you imagine, if you play any youth sports, baseball, football, basketball, kids are trying to figure out what field they're playing on, who's bringing the oranges for halftime, what, you know, field they're playing at, what the rain strategy is, all these things. Those are text messages that are being generally driven by an app that a team manager downloads and then distributes to the team. So when I started talking to this company, here was my story. Basically, I said, look, Kick, my company, is the leading platform for player carding, roster building, et cetera, in the industry. So imagine every time we create a new roster, the players and their family are automatically provided a link to download your app with pre-populated contacts. Because before, it was a very one by one, you know, I had to download it, invite Hollis, I had to invite Lovich, and I had to, you know, we had to basically build our team. Well, my company had the roster. So I said, hey, you win by default if you owned our company, because every roster would default to you. So instead of getting one at a time, you get a full team. And oh, by the way, we have 25,000 teams currently using our platform. I also knew from some research that they were interested in moving into the registration space. And so I said, hey, we also have a registration app. So that's the story I was telling to this prospective buyer number one. Well, at the same time, I was talking to a big media company. My company is exactly the same. I do the same thing every day. But this media company was interested in going from a largely baby boom demographic, Gen Z demographic, down to a youth market, because they were not appealing to that segment. So I had a different story. I said, hey, soccer is the largest sport in the world. And although you guys are huge in hockey, basketball, and some of these other categories, you don't own the soccer space. You have a huge sales force, but your team is going to have to literally cold call 9,000 youth soccer clubs in the United States. However, my company has a relationship with 6,000 of them currently using our technology, and we have an exclusive relationship. You can upsell them right now. And we have a couple of other relationships that we haven't even been able to take advantage of. So the point of this is, my company is exactly the same, but I'm talking to two different buyers, and my story is telling what's possible and the potential if they buy it, if they're the ones that win this bid. So the result, basically, ultimately, we end up selling the company to NBC Sports, who was buyer number two. They were the market leader, but we had these two companies really progressing, both willing to pay premiums well over, company wasn't even profitable yet. They were willing to pay premiums because of the story we were able to tell about what was possible if they were the ones that ultimately won the bid. So that's the power of storytelling, just with a quick example. So again, you just want to tell what is possible. All right, critical shift number three. I've got two more to cover. Find the best buyers. This is a really, really interesting one. It sounds obvious, but it's missed by a lot of entrepreneurs. So if you go back to those examples that I gave you, Microsoft purchasing Yammer and all these that really defied the odds, not only did they defy the odds, there's another common thread that is interesting. And that is, every one of these were acquired by buyers trying to enter a new market. So if I go back, you know, you look and say, all right, well, Google purchases a division of Motorola because they needed to be in the phone business. They needed to be in the handset business. Google didn't need Motorola because they had EBITDA. They didn't need customers. Google had all that. They needed to be in the handset business, right? Uber, or, you know, all these companies, Facebook purchases WhatsApp because they needed a messaging platform at scale. So these are people trying to enter new markets. So one of the strategies is to look at companies that are not in your market, but want to get in it. The most path of least resistance, the most common thing is, if you're a supplement company, you think, I'm doing 10 million. If I'm going to sell my company, I'm going to find a supplement company that's in my industry that's doing 100 million, a bigger version of myself. When the reality is, those companies know your margins, they know the challenges of the industry, they know all the goods and bads, so they are a likely interested party. They're also likely the smallest multiple that you'll find, because they're not going to pay a premium. If you find someone outside of that industry looking to get in and you're the answer to how they get in, that's when the premiums become significant. So that is a huge, huge opportunity for you as you think about how you might exit, is finding buyers in multiple industries. I recommend usually two or three minimally that are outside of your own. And so let me give you a quick example. So one of my companies many years ago had an outdoor apparel company called Mountain Khakis. If you don't know the brand, it was North Face, Patagonia, Columbia type companies. And when we started talking about selling the company, we talked to the family that owned Columbia. We talked to VF Corp that owned the North Face. I talked to Yvonne Chouinard at Patagonia. We were outselling all of those brands at retail in the pant category. But the reality was they all knew our business. They all knew the challenges. They all knew the margins. They knew all the factories. So when our company was approached by Remington, the gun company that was big into guns and ammo, and Cerberus that backed them, they expressed that they wanted to enter the outdoor space. So suddenly Mountain Khakis became a flag that they could put in the ground to enter the outdoor space and really signal to the market that they were diversifying away from guns and ammo. And so it was a really, really interesting outcome because we sold 75% of the company for probably double what the next closest industry buyer was offering us, simply because you have this external company, Remington and Guns and Ammo, looking to enter the market that we were already in. All right, so before we get to the last one, and again, apologies, I'm talking really quick, but I want to get through this so I can answer any questions. But I like to sort of imagine, if you are considering selling your company, what would a prospective buyer see today? And the way I do this is what I call the 8 a.m. Test. And this is a real quick scenario. So imagine late one Thursday afternoon, you're starting to think about your weekend. You've got this easy Friday ahead of you and your phone rings. And so you answer, "Hey, this is Mac speaking." Caller: "Mac, this is John Smith." Now, you know John because of his name. He's the CEO of your largest competitor, kind of an industry leader, maybe an industry icon. So he says, "Mac, I'm going to cut to the chase. I'm calling because we're interested in buying your company. And before you say a word, I want you to know that we're going to pay in cash. We're going to close in 30 days. We're going to pay above industry average multiples. We're really serious and like to make this happen. Are you interested?" First of all, nobody ever gets this call, but it's a good scenario. So, you know, your reaction is something like this, right? It's, "Wow, I have to admit, this is catching me off guard. I'm flattered. Sounds great. I'd love to learn more. Should we schedule a meeting? I could do something the week after next for sure." So that's kind of your knee-jerk reaction. And then he says, "Well, that's the catch. We're in town, my CFO and I, but we have to start due diligence tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. or this is a no-go." So if you get that call, what is your reaction, right? So you are imagining the biggest competitor in your space walking into your office at 8 a.m., starting due diligence, going through your files, looking at your processes, your SOPs, interviewing your employees, all the things that encompass due diligence. Are you ready for that? So if you imagine that scenario and, you know, you freak out, then that basically says you have an opportunity clearly to optimize so that you are ready at any and all times for these kind of scenarios. Even though that's not likely to happen, it is a real world visceral feeling of "I'm not ready." And even more powerfully, if you can imagine them not only showing up and feeling okay about it, but sort of smiling to yourself because you know you're so dialed in that they're going to be impressed. They're going to be like, "Damn, this is just better than anything I've seen." That's what you want to do. That's where you want to be. All right, last one, critical strategy number four. I say this is the most powerful strategy of all, and it is being proactive, not reactive. The reason for that is we just talked about that ADM scenario. That is a real world thing. Most founders, most companies get to the point where they decide, "Hey, I want to sell my company now, and let's go to market." Well, it's really too late to do some of the things that you could have and should have done. I found this in my own career. Looking back, I know I left millions on the table multiple times because there are little things I could have done that, given enough time, would have compounded into enormous value. Simple, simple tactical things, small strategic things, little decisions that compound over time. So I call it the super strategy because it's basically that exit lens to look at your business so that you can be proactive. And for me personally, I created this kind of lens when I, after I exited my sixth company, I was looking back over the 25 years of all the mistakes I'd made and all the things that, you know, had gone wrong. And then the few things that I could sort of pick out and say, hey, that actually worked really well, or that one was a particularly good outcome. Because I was thinking about the second chapter of my life and how would I really do the things that worked and avoid the things that didn't. And I found a really interesting thread. So I looked back over all those companies and I thought, you know what? All of the best decisions that we made, all the things that led to the most scale, to my personal freedom, which was important to me, and certainly our ability to exit, was when we started looking at our companies in a really specific way. It's basically that when we started looking at our companies through the lens of a prospective buyer, everything started to shift. Now, it didn't mean that that's the only lens that we used, right? We still had to make smart, strategic business decisions. But when we started saying, you know, how would a buyer look at this decision, right? How would they consider this? And the one example I really like is, you know, if you're thinking about expanding geographically, you may think a new office is really valuable because it puts a foothold in a new market for you and it allows you to have some local presence. Well, that may be a strategic asset for you as a, you know, growth company, but a prospective buyer might look at that and say, yeah, that's a liability. That is a real estate obligation that I have to take on. So the more you can look at your business through this lens, the more it can help clarify things and make really good decisions. So I would say the action item here is, you know, when you're looking at any key decision, any new hire, any new product you're thinking about launching, any geographic expansion, any capital raise, whatever those things are, there are a couple questions you can ask. You know, does this decrease or increase dependency on me as a founder? Because if it decreases dependency on you, your business is more sellable. It's more scalable. You've got more freedom. But if it increases, the reverse is true. Does this kind of decision excite a prospective buyer? Do they consider it, you know, something valuable? And does it add demonstrable value? You know, does this lead to intellectual property that we can package up and articulate to the market? Does it give us a competitive hurdle? You know, is there something that's really inherently valuable to this that a prospective buyer would get excited about? So that's something that's really actionable. And so that lens is something that you can use. It doesn't matter if you're going to sell your business in a year or 10 years. If you start just stepping out and sort of pulling the aperture a little wider and saying, you know, can I look at my business through the eyes of a prospective buyer? Because it's going to really change the way you view and think about business. All right. So to recap real fast, the secrets that we talked about: shift your thinking to creative, creating strategic value versus financial. If there's anything that will lead to a great outcome, more scale, more freedom, best exits, it is when you are focused on true strategic value. That's what buyers want. That's what differentiates you in the market. It is not financials. Developing an irresistible exit story. So you're selling the potential of everything that you've created. When you go out, number three, and you find the best buyers, the ones that are interested in entering your market. If you're a supplement company and you're in baby bathwater doing amazing things and you're talking to prospective buyers, if they're in the supplement industry, that may be fine. But imagine you go to a grocery store chain that doesn't have their own brand and they want to buy a brand. They want to buy an existing supply chain. That's a totally different conversation and likely a totally different multiple and outcome. Develop exit DNA so you can start preparing now. And the idea is just weaving this concept into the fabric of your organization. So you're asking these questions, you're thinking about it from this lens. All right, I will stop there. I apologize for how quickly I went through that, but I really wanted to get a bunch of stuff out.
That's good. It's a speedy crowd and they've heard the preamble, but that was like a much better way of diving into it. I think it was great.
Yeah, if nobody has questions, I'm sure we can come up with some.
Yeah, but I do know there are people with them.
If anybody has questions, type in the all panelists and attendees or raise your hand or something, or else we'll ask. Mm-hmm. Everybody's shy. I'll keep it going, man. So there we go. Reed, how did you know when and what feeling were you looking to achieve with the exit of each company? I don't think we need to go through each company.
So, you know, one of the things that I think, again, only in hindsight, because I wasn't smart enough to like proactively think about this stuff earlier in my career. But, you know, I realize now looking back that I happen to have a relatively broad view. Maybe it was non-stereotypical founder. I loved my companies. I mean, every company I created, I was passionate about. I loved building it. I was, you know, it's something I wanted to see. I would have been happy growing it to, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars. But ultimately, staring at the market and thinking about, you know, what's going on in the macroeconomic environment, what's happening within my industry, my competitive space, you know, what's happening around me, what are the human dynamics, what are my investors or strategic partners thinking? Those things tend to bubble up in my, you know, kind of view. The timing is really important. And so rather than me just saying, hey, you know, I want to sell my company now, I really tried to look at all those things that were going on externally as, you know, part of the factors. And so in most every case, there was some signal in my mind that would say, you know what, you know, you either need to double down now or find an exit. And in several, you know, cases, I kind of ran parallel paths. I considered I could sell it. I could raise more money. I could go it alone. And if you have a great exit story, you know, multiple times I got offers that I couldn't refuse, basically. So that's kind of how I tend to think about it. And I think right now we're living in one of those moments, you know, people that I was working with a year ago, I honestly think a lot of them thought I was crazy because I would talk about the macroeconomic environment and consumer spending and recessions. And everybody's like, yeah, we're in this bull market, you know, raging run. What are you talking about? You know, until it isn't, right? Until COVID hits or the market crashes. And so I was, you know, I was holding a $15 million term sheet in March of 2000, smoking a cigar going up a ski lift going, yeah, this is going to be great. And a week later, the NASDAQ crashes, you know? So it's like, you have to look at those external factors, not just how your business is performing. So that's been a big one for me.
Yeah.
We have a question from Lisa. What are your thoughts on keeping real estate and selling just the business?
Yeah, it's a good question. So, you know, one of the things that I mentioned, you know, I love this idea of sort of stacking strategic value. And one of the benefits of stacking strategic value is to some degree, you can also parcel them out, right? Some buyers, if you're truly selling a company and you have real estate, maybe you're a retail operation, or you have some, you know, kind of connection between your products and services and a retail front or something.
A hotel and a restaurant and things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, some buyers, like the real estate is going to drive their interest. Other buyers are interested in the brand, yet others are interested in products and services you offer. So being able to sort of bifurcate those and say, hey, we could sell either or both, or I'm going to keep one back. That just starts giving you optionality. So I think, you know, that's what you want, in my opinion, is optionality. And then if your buyer doesn't want, or if you want to retain real estate and your buyer was interested in it, then, you know, it puts you in a highly leveraged position to negotiate favorable terms. And so I like the optionality around that.
Wouldn't that go into follow up to preparation, that last part, you know, getting ready. So would that be an example of something you want to prepare for so you don't have your real estate too commingled? So would you get ready then for that so you have optionality when you prepare, just like not creating dependency on yourself?
Yeah, it's one of the things. I mean, it is preparation, because any way you want to lean it, you just don't want to get caught off guard. If you've decided that you want to retain it yourself, then you have to completely segment it out so that all your due diligence is focused on the business without the real estate. Because the minute it's commingled, to your point, you know, it creates confusion. It creates, oh, let me explain, you know, and anytime in due diligence you say, let me explain, that throws up a yellow flag. And then a red flag follows with lower valuation. So I'm all about, like, make this a frictionless very easy to articulate kind of process. So anything
the lens you're talking about, right? So if you're going to open, say it's a restaurant, a new restaurant, there's a real estate purchase involved. The restaurant might have separate LLCs that own those two that could be purchased together or not, but you've prepped it so that they're clean, separate entities.
Exactly. Yeah.
Love it. Right.
And I know Kyle has a question that he'd like to be called on for. So Kyle, we can prep you for that, but we got a follow-up here. Oh, well, we might as well just tag him in.
I could just read out loud either way. Kyle, do you want to get popped in there? Ask it yourself. It's a long one. Just Natalie's bring Kyle in.
He's too handsome. We need to bring him in.
All right. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Hey, I was trying to distill that question because it's, you know, mine's pretty lengthy, but without reading it, it's just, you know, I own a franchise home service business with Windows, and you know, we in the past, you know, growth has come from adding additional franchisees, but you know, looking at the problems we're having in terms of, you know, some of our franchisees in the past are top performers, some are middling operators, and some are awful and they need to be moved up or out. And you know, the goal in the past was just to get as many franchisees as possible. But what I've seen recently with the problems we're having, it's like maybe we should be going deeper in the markets we're in. And, you know, in terms of helping our current franchisees become great and the ones that can't become great, like buy them out or move them out with contractual obligations, where a corporate team runs those entities. Basically, the whole point behind this is like to give myself more autonomy and then obviously position to sell if that was ever going to happen. But I'm not sure which is the best way to approach it. You know, franchising comes with less capital. It's less capital intensive, but you lose control because that franchisee can either be great or they can be not so great.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'm on the board of a franchise group that's got like 120 or so locations. And, you know, that like all franchise groups, they've wrestled with, you know, some of these same issues. And what I would say is, you know, in most cases, buyers are interested in what is working and what's possible. And so if you have enough franchisees already in place to say, hey, you know, we've proven that there's demand for selling franchise locations, so you've got a pipeline, right? Then it's actually more powerful, in my opinion, and more interesting to really dial in and improve the ones that you have, because that's the story. It's like, okay, it's working really well. Here's the margin, here's the sell through, all the things that you're, you know, sort of KPIs. But then you show them the pipeline and say, hey, if you were to buy the business, there's, you know, 150 other people ready to go. Rather than having this kind of mixed bag of some underperformers, some do great, some don't. So I kind of like the, you know, early part of, you know, prove it out, get enough franchise locations or franchisees to demonstrate demand, demonstrate diversity, but don't, you know, focus so much on growth that it's just like checking off the numbers, because you can do that with a spreadsheet, which is your pipeline, without really taking on all the risk of underperforming franchise locations. So that's, you know, kind of my knee-jerk reaction is pulling it in, getting the ones that you can work in really well, and then having some pent-up demand for growth is a good time to, you know, imagine exiting.
Thank you. That makes sense. Yeah, I appreciate that.
I have a question I know that's come up a lot in these conversations at events and stuff is valuation. Like, I know that some people say, oh, that's just made up by your accountant who compares it to this multiple, or it seems to be the most magical part of this, of how people come up with their valuation when they're first starting this process. I'm just sort of your overall thoughts on how people go about that.
Yeah, it's an important question, because, you know, the baseline is, as we kind of talked about earlier, is, you know, the financial multiple. So you can go out and take your last 12 months revenue and your last 12 months EBITDA and do some very basic multiples and say that's where the majority of the market would value your business. that is selling it dramatically short, in my opinion, and yet that's where most transactions happen. So if you're trying to avoid that and you think about, you know, where, how do you value something that's kind of off the spreadsheet? It's not easy, but I would say, you know, the real interesting way to think about it is it's all in the eyes of the buyer. So if you are selling a supplement company, let's use that example again, that's at, you know, 10 million in revenue and has a great, powerful line, but you know, the buyer has 100,000 active customers and you know what your lifetime value is, your math doesn't matter. It is, what is the lifetime value times 100,000 customers? Like, that's basically the immediate lift the buyer is going to get. And so there's this arbitrage for you to say, I just want some of that. I just want a little bit of that lift. And so the more you can shift your thinking to, what am I delivering to this buyer? You know, and if it's a public company, public companies are really easy because everything's public record. You can see that, you know, if you sell your company to them for 20 times EBITDA, the second it closes, they may be trading at 40 times earnings. Well, that arbitrage in the middle, they're getting all the benefit of. So if I was selling to a public company, I would say, you know, here's my valuation, here's all my value, and I want some of that immediate value you're going to get because of public company arbitrage. So it's really shifting to, you know, in the eyes of the buyer, eyes of the beholder is where all of the value is. So I get a lot of people I work with trying to do the math and imagining what if you plug, you know, my products into their distribution channel.
So it seems like that's like, you know, Lisa just asked, should I get a valuation done? And people have those ideas of, oh, well, there's these companies you hire that do it, but they don't have that same perspective that you have, right? That's more like the real estate world where you hire the business broker and he says, here's how much we can get. And they throw it out. Yeah. In that sense, do you prefer that the buyer is coming up with that number first or that the seller is coming up with that number first?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm super opinionated. So I would caveat everything that this is just like, you know, Max view of the world, which is, you know, worth whatever, a nickel. But you know, I don't think having a valuation done is really valuable because you can do the back of the napkin math that I just shared. You know, you can do a quick Google search for, you know, comps and say, you know, what are companies in my industry trading at on financial multiples? You can go to your CPA and ask a few questions, but it's really a blunt instrument. Like, to me, that is the absolute baseline just on your numbers. What are you worth? But that doesn't really give you credit for the intellectual capital that you have, the intellectual property that you have, the sure. value of your brand in someone else's hands. And so, unfortunately, you know, the valuation doesn't give you that. And that is why I think it is the opportunity. And yet the challenge is the founder has a huge role to play in that. Like, I believe I can sell my company for a whole lot more than most investment bankers simply because I'm not constrained by valuation on a spreadsheet. I am looking at it, trying to be creative.
So a good way to attract the wrong buyer. Because, you know, kind of what I'm hearing is you're going, it's all about taking second position and what's it from their point of view and then coming in. And it's also a make versus buy decision a lot of times. Like selling software in the old days was they can make it themselves or buy it, right? And this is a more sophisticated way of looking at the same thing. So it sounds like, summarize, you're taking second position and then showing them that, what a fucking deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you show them all that and then go, you can make this and this much, you know, but I'm just going to give it to you for this.
Exactly.
That seems to be the hook.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And that's why, you know, the more you know about companies, one of the other things I always recommend people do is if you make a list of prospective buyers, even if you have no idea if they would be interested, and you create a Google alert and you just start reading their press releases 15 minutes a day, in 6 months, they will tell you exactly where they're trying to go as a company. They will tell you their CEO will be doing earnings calls and talking about their new products and their new vision. And all you're doing is going, hey, you know what? My company is actually helping them get where they want to go. I know they've told me that's where we want to go. So it's a simple way to just start lining up that value.
No, I like that because that goes into your mentality of don't just look at, it's like your Mountain Khakis example, right? Like when you go to make your list of prospective buyers, don't just go to the people who already do what you do. Think through like, five, six different buckets of folks that are different and create those, because that's probably where your bigger lift will be anyway.
That's exactly right. If you, the more you can think about, you know, who wants to be in your business that isn't in there today, and what story would you tell them about why your company solves that for them? You've got everything done. They literally, it's like you hand them a package and they're in your industry. Those are the buyers that, like, what's the math? I mean, you know, what's it worth for Google to be in the phone business? You know, it's all any spreadsheet, right? So
totally. I love it. So on the last slide, you were talking about back to preparing. One of your bullet points was don't create dependency on yourself as you're making every decision, right? Because you obviously don't, what's the point of exiting if you have to go with it?
Right.
And then also a company probably wouldn't be as interested if you were doing everything, then they're dependent on you. So I know Hollis and I keep bugging you about this because we keep asking you privately, but I think if you could share some of that with the group, I've learned a lot already from you about that one, which I think is one of the most important things I've ever heard.
Yeah, no, I think it's a little bit counterintuitive in some cases. You know, what allows you as a entrepreneur, as a founder, to get to a certain level on your kind of path or journey is because you're talented and skilled, right? You're passionate and you care about it and you know it. Well, that's all perfect until that is actually the thing that constrains your growth, because you're no longer the best person to create the software, you know, package and do the finances and be in the sales meetings and, you know, and. So just by the obvious, you know, you can't be great at everything kind of analysis, there is a point at which in your business, you know, you are the constraint to growth. But the reason I like this exit lens is because, you know, you think about it and go, all right, well, yeah, if I want to sell my company, if you're, you know, if someone were to come in and look at Baby Bathwater today, just to, you know, be, you know, highly, you know, direct and critical, probably being more stereotypical than anything, is like, it could easily look like, well, it's Hollis and Lovitch, and there's some structure and it's got a cool vibe, but, like, you know, they are the business, you know? And the reality is that the business? I mean, it's a membership. No, it's an event company. No, it's a media company. You know, like you can twist and bend it a lot of different ways to tell stories about what is Baby Bathwater, none of which should be the founders. The founders got it going, the founders got it started, but a buyer wants to believe that the business is bigger than the founder. They don't want, you know, even if you were willing to go with them, they don't want to lock you down for a 6-year employment agreement, hoping that you can, you know, take your face off the business and transition to them. They want to buy businesses that have, you know, SOPs in terms of how does everything run in the absence of the founder? Right. What happens if a person leaves? Does it immediately pick up and run like nothing ever changed? And so I think that's a really key factor, not only in creating exits, but just, you know, creating freedom in your own life. Because otherwise you're in the middle of every process.
Yeah, they might want Hollis, but they certainly wouldn't want me. Come on, that'd be crazy. No, it's super valuable. What are some strategies? So, because you told us some really interesting stories about a lot of people who worked for you have ended up going on to do big things. And
yeah, so one of my, you know, philosophies, which makes a lot of people, you know, uncomfortable, is I sort of believe in this, you know, hire the best people you can at any level, right? Interns on up to, you know, senior executives, but you basically throw them in the deep end almost right away. And uncomfortably so. And so I think you guys heard me say, you know, in my companies early on, when I made a commitment to my family and my daughters that I was going to be home at 5 o'clock at dinner, you know, I think it shocked people for the first week or two at 4:30 when I would stand up in the middle of the meeting and walk out the door. But what happens very quickly is people realize you're not kidding, you are leaving. And life needs to go on. And so good people figure out, okay, how do we run the meeting when Mac leaves in the middle? How do we run the meeting if Mac isn't there at all? Even to the point, my last company, you know, I was the largest shareholder, I was chairman, but I did not have a shared calendar with the company, and they never knew if I was going to be in the office or not, which just meant they had to prepare for every meeting as if I wasn't going to be there.
That's cool.
And I reserve the right, you know, technically, right, as founder or whatever, I could say, hey, I could walk into a meeting and kind of insert myself, not to be a jerk, but just to say, hey, I want to participate. But it's really powerful, not only for you, because it completely pulls you out of the process, but you witness very quickly how fast good people swim, how fast they progress. So yeah, I think the story I was sharing with you is, you know, here in my hometown, there are two separate people that started with me as unpaid interns that are now running venture-backed, you know, companies as CEOs. And that duration was not a decade. It was a couple of years. And it was like unpaid intern to executive to leaving and starting their own company. But that's because, you know, I threw them in the deep end and just said, hey, you know, I'm gone. I may be back in a week. I may not. I mean, you know, they have to figure it out. And so that really has had a huge impact on not only my freedom, but also our ability to create sellable assets.
Quick follow-up on that. When do you know if they're drowning in the deep end? And when do you know that they're going to make it back up? Because I could see this leaving and then shit, company's gone. So how do you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, you know, I heard someone say a long time ago, and I agree with the philosophy of, you know, hire slow and fire fast. I mean, when something's not working, you have to make the quick call to, you know, let people go. It probably means, you know, they're going to be better off finding something that's a better fit. And it could be as something as simple as, you know, it's cultural, it's not their skill set or whatever. So, you know, making a decision to pull the ripcord quickly, hard for a lot of people, but the right thing to do. And the other is, you know what your KPIs, know what you care about. You know, if you're an entrepreneur, stereotypical entrepreneur, you will know if you're not in the meeting, it will not go the same as if you were there and maybe not as good as if you were there. That's okay. You have to sort of get comfortable that it's going to be a little bit different because I'm not there. So once you get that comfort, then you can focus on, you know, what are the metrics that matter and how can I train or teach this person to dial in the metrics, not take on my style. Because I know if I'm in the meeting, it's going to be handled my way. But what I really care about is not that it's done my way, but that the metrics are getting hit, right? That we're growing at the rate we want, that we're doing the things that we care about. So if you can kind of get your mind shifted onto, you know, KPIs and metrics and training for those things and getting your ego out of the way, that's typically the best way to see if it's truly a failure or if it's just your ego saying they're not doing a good job.
Right. No, that makes perfect sense. So one of the things that I know a lot of this has been about exit. But when we initially started talking about this, we were talking about how we could get ready for a recap as a way to actually, you know, COVID came, we had to cancel all the events and we're looking at what kind of things can we do to do that. And so this whole idea of being prepared for this and making decisions about how other people are going to view you isn't just about getting rid of the entire thing at one transaction. It could be a small recapitalization, bringing on a strategic partner, things like that are probably something that you should know that that's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, I would say it's a really good point. And I've struggled a little bit with even the name Exit DNA because it's really about, you know, you do want to create the option. I mean, almost it's like 3/4 of all entrepreneurs want to sell at some point in the future. So you certainly want the option. You want to know that you have maximized that. But the reality is the process of recapitalizing the business, raising capital, doing a huge merger, doing a joint venture, doing a strategic partnership, even bringing on a really, really senior partner or executive, the same exact set of, you know, rules or critical shifts apply, right? It's all about, you know, creating strategic value. It's all about being able to tell that story of potential and where you're going. And that's what gets anybody excited to invest in your company, you know, recapitalize it, you know, double down with you, whatever it is that your objective is, the same set of strategic rules sort of apply. So it is much broader than just sort of designing for exit. Cause I am not a build to flip, you know, kind of person, despite my exits. Like I said, any one of those, I would have continued to run it, you know, if the set of circumstances would have played out, I could have, you know, continued to run them exactly the same. So.
Awesome. Well, I think this was very helpful and see if there's, I think that's all our questions, but I'm sure we'll get more when we release the replay to the group here. But really appreciate you taking the time to run everyone through how your brain works.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me. You know, Baby Bathwater is this, you know, amazing group. I mean, you guys have assembled and filtered out, but the people I've met and worked with within Baby Bathwater are so strong and talented at building their business. You know, yeah, if nothing else, it's just a framework to consider, because there are some amazing businesses, and I can only imagine, you know, in a year or two, just thinking about, you know, what's going to happen with this group of humans. So yeah, if I can be helpful in any way, you know, reach out, I'm happy to help.
Every time I hear you talk, I have more questions for you. So this is great.
I love it. I used to talk about the group in a different way because I only could see things one way of like, hey, they're really good at building lean, profitable businesses and they're not doing all this VC stuff. But now that I've seen the people you've been working with and as the businesses have grown over time, it's like, oh my gosh, there is, you know, we had blind spots as we all will continue to have unless we communicate and see other ways of thinking.
Oh yeah.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure chatting with you guys. And again, if I can help anyone, don't hesitate to, you know, hit me up. Happy to do it.
You got it. Awesome. Thanks, y'all.